This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where you, me and the top experts come together to understand the great issues of the day inside 28 minutes. In this edition, with another round of fighting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, we're asking, who are Hamas and what do they want? At first sight, it's been the same bloody same old. The tiny, populous enclave of Gaza, governed by the organisation called Hamas, firing unsophisticated rockets indiscriminately into Israel and being bombed by the high-tech Israeli Air Force, with many civilians killed, until eventually a ceasefire is agreed. And that's as far as we often get in understanding what's going on. But to comprehend why this cycle is repeated, and whether there's a chance of stopping it, you need the answer to the questions, who are Hamas and what do they want? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. History time. I'm joined by Jennifer Jeffries, teaching professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program in Washington, D.C., and the author of Hamas, Terrorism, Governance and Its Future in Middle East Politics. Jennifer Jeffries, when and how did Hamas first emerge?
So we see Hamas emerge as an organization in 1987, 5 days after the first Intifada begins. And you had the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was the internationally recognized sole legitimate voice of the Palestinian people at that point in time. And they were caught off guard by the start of this Intifada. And we can contrast this with Hamas, because Hamas had its roots in the social and religious networks of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood in Palestine thought of themselves as very much a social welfare organization. So they sought to develop schools, social programs, you know, sports groups, religious study groups. This is not to say, of course, that they weren't also committed to political objectives. And so Hamas came on board to push forward in the Palestinian cause, but from a very different angle than the PLO had done. Hamas brought in a more religious perspective. And so when you see Hamas in its early development, which began essentially with leaflets being distributed during the time of the Intifada, endorsing the violence that was being undertaken by Palestinians and saying that this violence was justified, potentially even, you know, sort of called for by Islam because of the injustice that had been pervasive throughout the time since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948.
And as they developed, what were their core beliefs? They were, of course, a religious organization. What were their core political beliefs when it came to Israel?
If we think of their beliefs as forming this triangle, and certainly Israel is at the center of that triangle, but I do think you have to kind of be aware of the other corners as well. And so one corner, as you say, absolutely is religious. Their initial charter, the leaflets that they spread throughout the first Intifada, they describe themselves in these documents as just being completely identified by Islam. Then you've got your second corner, which is this corner of nationalism, or we can call it politics. And then I would say that that third corner is their use of violence, which again, you see them making a central part, if not of their identity, at least of their right to preserve their identity.
Would it be right to have characterized them as essentially rejecting the movements towards peace that the Fatah and the Palestine Liberation Organization, Fatah being the main other significant political group, were undertaking?
Yes. I mean, we're talking, of course, about the Oslo Accords. And when you think about their push towards nationalism, you really see that coming into focus when you have the PLO doing what Hamas considers to be a huge betrayal of the Palestinian cause. And so in the years following the efforts to implement Oslo, Hamas absolutely worked deliberately as a spoiler within that process, because they considered that entire process to reject the religious, the nationalist, and the sort of structural elements that gave the Palestinian people what they saw their purpose to be.
They were also prepared to use what seemed at the time to be very extreme acts of violence.
Yes, and I would say that that is something that has continued in most of the time. We've seen that, you know, designated specifically against Israel and to Israeli civilians. But you also saw they have a willingness to use force against, you know, Palestinians.
Let's come on to exactly that. So you have Hamas, which is a different organization to Fatah and the PLO, not even under the wing of the PLO. How does Hamas end up controlling Gaza?
Okay, so September of 1993, Israel and the PLO signed the Oslo Accords. In this agreement, you get the creation of the Palestinian National Authority, or as we refer to it, is the PA. And the idea behind these accords, of course, is that over time, the Palestinian territories that were agreed upon in this agreement would be slowly shifted from influential Israeli control over into the hands of this PA. So they set up shop, right, in Gaza, and then Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza in 2005. This wasn't exactly along the lines of the original agreement in the sense that, you know, it wasn't as though everything was going swimmingly. And so Israel said, looks like you guys have got this, we'll just back out. It was more that there was, you know, significant violence coming out as an intent by Hamas and other groups to spoil the Oslo Accords. Now, the idea was that there would be then no further incentive for violence to come out of Gaza. And of course, as we know, it didn't exactly work out that way. And this is in part because Hamas won this surprise victory in the Palestinian elections of 2006. And so this triggers the withdrawal of international support for the PA. And then this is further exacerbated by what, I mean, kind of amounts to a small arms race. And so then the next several months are categorized by efforts to equal parts of efforts to form a unity government and then armed attacks by both sides. And this culminated with Abbas announcing the dissolution of the elected government and declaring a state of emergency in 2007. And then after this, you effectively have the creation of two different Palestines, one run by Hamas in Gaza and one by the PA in the West Bank.
Now, let's just talk a little bit about Hamas's internal decision-making and so on. Are there and have there been different wings to Hamas? Is there a moderate wing and a more militant wing?
To some degree, it's within Hamas's interest to suggest that there are these different wings. In particular, we see them often talk about sort of this semi, if not fully autonomous, Izzaddin al-Qassam brigades. You know, the Qassam rocket brigades are fully separate from the political decision-making wing of Hamas. Part of the reason that Hamas wants that narrative to be part of the global vernacular is that they use this to argue that they should be declassified as a terrorist organization, right? Because if the al-Qassam brigades can be a separate entity, then technically Hamas becomes just sort of any other political player within Palestine.
Jennifer Jeffries. So that's how Hamas grew to prominence and left us a situation whereby Fatah, the main part of the old PLO, runs part of the West Bank and Hamas rules Gaza. But what is the basis of Hamas's political power? I'm joined in the briefing room by Dr. Nina Musgrave from the Centre for Defence Studies, King's College London. She's also author of a forthcoming book, Hamas and the Arab Uprising. Nina Musgrave, what political power does Hamas practically have?
So at the moment, Hamas's political strength would be that it sees itself as the most legitimate organisation in terms of the project to liberate Palestine. So Hamas would view itself as spearheading the Palestinian cause. And its political aims would be to remain at the forefront of this quest to liberate Palestine and to continue to do so through political participation. I would also say that Hamas has traditionally always looked for legitimacy from Western governments and institutions in particular. And this is where it tries to differentiate itself from other jihadist organizations. But its popularity boils down to its self-identification as spearheading the Palestinian cause.
In terms of its actual capacity to affect things, what political power does it have?
Internally, in terms of governance, Hamas has had a very challenging time. That is mainly because of the Gaza Strip being so challenged by outside forces and Hamas not being very good at governance in the first place. So that has been a massive challenge. But I would say that one of the things about Hamas is that it's one of these groups that at times you look at observers who talk about Hamas and they say, oh, Hamas has gone quiet or it's been marginalized or it's been isolated by the Arab Spring. Actually, despite the fact that Hamas poses no existential threat to Israel, it has an amazing ability to reassert itself on the world stage very quickly.
So it runs Gaza. Does it have any significant presence in other Palestinian territories?
Yes, it does have a significant presence in the West Bank. But a lot of its leadership there are quite challenged by the Palestinian Authority. A lot of them have been imprisoned over time. So there is a presence in the West Bank. They have political representatives there. And they also have their student bodies in the universities. But their home is the Gaza Strip.
What can we tell about whether it's still popular in the Gaza Strip or indeed anywhere else? I mean, one of the most recent events was the decision to call off the Palestinian elections. So there hasn't been an electoral test for a very long time, has there?
Exactly. So, yes, its popularity has waxed and waned over the time. But also you have to remember, while Hamas's popularity may have gone down a little bit, Fatah's popularity has not exactly skyrocketed. And this is why Hamas won the elections back in January 2006 in the first place, because it had done so much work in civil society, because Hamas operates on this ethos of mukawama, it's like resistance. And so it's resistance in all forms. It's about engagement in civil society and charity work and also jihad. When Hamas initially went down the route of political participation, it was campaigning on the knowledge and using the frustration of the Palestinian electorate with Fatah's endemic corruption. And that hasn't changed.
Can you tell us about Hamas's main leaders, who are pretty much an unknown quantity to most of our listeners?
So it's quite complicated because you have the Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip, but then you have an external leadership. So Hamas's leader at the moment in the Gaza Strip is Yahya Sinwar. Years ago, he was very, very high up in Hamas's military wing. He was imprisoned for 22 years and was released during the prisoner swap in 2011. He is now head of the Gaza Strip. And people say he's been surprisingly pragmatic when it comes to political decisions. And then the rest of the main leadership is actually based in, at the moment, in Doha. So you have Ismail Haniyeh, you have Khaled Mashal. They run Hamas's external side of Hamas, because the thing with Hamas is that for years, because they were so entrenched in the Gaza Strip and they couldn't travel, they called it suitcase diplomacy, which would allow a Hamas leader to travel around and gain allegiances and get funding and engage in negotiations.
So foreign and external support for Hamas is important to the organisation. Can you tell us about that?
It is very, very important. So it gets a lot of support from Iran, from Turkey, from Qatar. But Hamas's foreign policy has also been quite complicated because for a long time, its external bureau was in Syria. But then when the Arab Spring broke out, and in particular in Syria, when the uprising started to happen in Syria, Hamas just couldn't stand by and watch the Assad regime commit these atrocities on its own people. That was a big turning point because it showed Hamas's pragmatism and it showed how it conceives its own principles.
Now, what is your understanding of Hamas's political aims, its realistic political aims?
So I think you've just asked the most difficult question about Hamas because you put the word realistic in there. I would say Hamas's political aims would be to remain at the forefront of the quest for the liberation of Palestine. However, if this current conflict wasn't happening, I would be answering this question a bit differently. Because I would have said, craving legitimacy from the West would have been one of the main things Hamas is looking for as a political aim. But now, considering this latest conflict, I'm not entirely sure, because these kinds of behaviours, these kinds of conflicts with Israel will never endear Hamas to Western states or institutions.
Is Hamas's perception, looking at previous wars with Israel, that it is stuck in a pattern which doesn't alter and which doesn't advance?
Without speaking for them, I would imagine so. There was an interview a few days ago with one of the Hamas leaders saying this latest conflict is a strategic shift for the group. And I read it and I thought, what a load of nonsense. It isn't a strategic shift. It's cyclical. I think the only real difference between this current conflict is that there's more violence inside Israel itself.
Nina Musgrave doubting the claim of some great strategic shift. All the same, this time round, Hamas has fired thousands of rockets into Israel. So what is Hamas's military capability? Joining me in the briefing room now is Fabian Hintz, an independent open source intelligence analyst who specialises in Middle East missiles. Fabian Hintz, do we know what Hamas's military capability was at the beginning of this latest round of fighting?
So basically, Hamas used the last few years to build up a pretty large rocket arsenal. Estimates vary a little bit, from about 13,000 rockets to up to 30,000 rockets of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad combined. But they had a pretty decent arsenal, and it included both imported stuff, but also stuff they produced domestically. And I would say they have a pretty small but nimble force when it comes to firing these rockets. We know they probably also use timers, so once the rockets are fired and the Israelis destroy the launchers, they won't lose any of their men. And they have a small naval force. They have some frogmen, which they use for various tasks. And according to Israel, they also had some kamikaze submarine drones, which they attempted to use. So there are quite a few technical novelties that are quite creative, one could say.
At a crude level from outside, take from my perspective, this is now the third or fourth time I've seen the repetition of this form of military action, and it just looks like the same old, same old. When you look at the weapons being deployed, is it really like that, or has something changed?
The thing that has really changed with this round of confrontation is just the number of rockets used and the pace of rocket use, and especially the number of rockets used being simultaneously in an attempt to overwhelm Iron Dome, that's the Israeli defense system, against short-range rockets. And the ability of Hamas and PIJ to launch whole volleys of rockets at faraway targets like Tel Aviv and try to overwhelm Iron Dome there, that's a really big change in terms of numbers, tactics, and the combination of both.
PIJ is Palestinian Islamic Jihad, right?
Exactly.
Now, how do they get all these rockets? I mean, and the components for all these rockets?
That's a really, really fascinating story. So when you look at the history of the rocket arsenal in Gaza, it started off with like really crudely improvised rockets. Like these were basically the size of model rockets. Sometimes they used similar fuels as model rockets, and they had abysmal ranges, so like 2 to 4 kilometers. Then they had some imported stuff, which they smuggled, usually of Iranian, sometimes Syrian origin, with far greater ranges, up to 75 or 160 kilometers, enough to target Tel Aviv. But, you know, smuggling into Gaza is really difficult. And what we've seen over the last decade, I would say, is really the emergence of a local rocket industry that manages to produce still simpler rockets, but with longer ranges and in greater numbers. And there is a clear Iranian fingerprint here, because basically Iranian commanders, Hamas cadres, PIJ cadres are pretty open about the fact that Iran has helped a lot with this domestic rocket production. Which doesn't mean that there's still some improvisation, because it's still difficult to get the basic materials for building these designs into Gaza. So they improvise a lot. They use old water piping to build rocket motors. In one instance, they actually used old British World War I shells, which they salvaged from a sunken freighter to build warheads. But there's also this Iranian technical influence.
Now, insofar as Hamas has a military capability, what would you say its purpose was?
So I would say there's a larger strategy to it. I think the idea behind the Hamas rocket arsenal is not to, at least for the moment, really dent Israeli military capabilities. They're well aware they can do that. But when they fire their rockets, even if most of them get intercepted, it has a certain psychological effect on the Israeli public. Now, you can call that like in cold-hearted Machiavellian terms a psychological effect. You can say it's terrorizing the population, whatever you prefer. And they really want to administer that in a very tactically smart move and increase that effect with each round of escalation to build up some sort of deterrence. I think the idea for Hamas is to have a situation, let's say 1 year from now, when this round of conflict is already forgotten by most people, and Israeli decision makers are pondering some decision, whether they want to do something in the West Bank or whether they want to strike a certain military capability of Hamas. And when they take that decision, they will still very much have this latest round of confrontation in their minds, and it will influence their decision. Again, if you look at the way Hezbollah has built up its deterrent forces, it has actually worked quite well. So if you look at it from a, let's say, Iranian Revolutionary Guards perspective, a Hamas perspective, a Hezbollah perspective, they actually have been really successful in transforming their, in the beginning, really shoddy rocket arsenal into a major deterrent force. And they can use that sort of deterrent to even further increase their capabilities. So I think that's the kind of pattern they would like to emulate.
Looked at coldly in the way in which, let's say, Hamas's military wing would attempt to assess their success or failure, will they be looking at what they've done so far and said, we've achieved something?
In the West, we tend to look at military affairs in a very strictly military and technological way, also because we're good at that. And if you look at the tactics of non-state actors in the Middle East and also in general actors allied with Iran, it's much more psychological. It's not so much how much did we manage to destroy, it's did we achieve this deterrent effect? Did we manage to pull off surprises? Did we manage to fire rockets until the last day so that we can phrase this as the enemy had to beg for a ceasefire while we're still shelling Tel Aviv? And if you look at it from this more psychological point of view, I think they achieved quite a bit of what they wanted.
Fabian hints on a capability that seems to be growing. So what is the Israeli government's thinking as it confronts Hamas? In the briefing room now is Natan Sachs, the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Natan Sachs, what was Israel's objective in this latest round of hostilities with Hamas?
The objectives were mostly military. They were tactical and operational, and there really wasn't much strategy behind it, which of course is a problem. What the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, wanted to do was to degrade Hamas's ability to fight, in particular to launch rockets. What the Israelis tried to do in response, but actually they had prepared it a long time in advance in the case of war, was to take out what they're calling the subway of Gaza, which is a nickname they gave to many, many kilometers of tunnels, expensive tunnels that were built under the Gaza Strip, under the city, but also under many of the civilian places in the Gaza Strip. And that is where much of Hamas operations are taking place from. Israel had managed through intelligence efforts in the past years to uncover where those were and to map those out. And its objective, whenever the next violence would have been, was to take out this underground. Beyond that, on strategy, there seems to be a lacuna. They're talking about undermining Hamas's will and ability to fight and deterring Hamas, vague terms that mask vague strategy.
When we look at Israel's long-term estimation of Hamas, what is that and how has that evolved?
Israel and Israelis writ large view Hamas very much through the lens of Hamas violence. Hamas, unlike its rival Fatah, has been steadfastly against peace negotiations with Israel. And the evolution of Israelis' relations to Hamas have really gone through stages of Hamas's abilities to exact a price from Israelis. It started in the first Intifada, where Hamas became increasingly active and kidnapped soldiers, attacked civilians, attacked settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And then later, and especially in the 90s, it became very prominent with suicide bombing. This was the way Israelis viewed Hamas, as a deadly, incorrigible enemy, one that was unwilling to compromise. That took another evolution, in particular, when after Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip, Hamas won Palestinian elections, and then Hamas took over the Gaza Strip. What was left was a statelet, a very small, very crowded statelet in the Gaza Strip that Israel viewed as an incorrigible foe, in a sense, that had been firing rockets already, relatively primitive rockets, much less effective than we see today, but nonetheless was firing rockets at Israeli civilians around the Gaza Strip. And the Israelis blockaded what has become a very long and very, very damaging blockade of the Gaza Strip, alongside the Egyptians, who also have a border with the Gaza Strip. Since then, we've seen four rounds now of violence.
Was there ever a constituency in Israel that thought that there might be a constituency within Hamas
which was amenable to talks of one kind or another or to compromise.
There is a constituency, including in the Israeli establishment, that believes that Hamas would be willing to negotiate with Israel over a ceasefire, perhaps a prolonged ceasefire, Hudna in Arabic, maybe for 10 years. There is virtually no constituency in Israel, not just on the right or the center, but including on the left, the peace camp of old, who believes Hamas is willing to have an actual peace agreement recognizing Israel or accepting Israel's existence as a legitimate thing. That does not exist, in part because Hamas adamantly states that it is not willing to accept such a thing. It views Israel as a cancer in the Middle East and as a religious abomination on what is Islamic land. That does not mean that it is beyond pragmatism. Of course, it would like to achieve its own goals. Those include establishing more control and having a say in the West Bank, taking leadership of the Palestinian movement. For that, it may be willing to have negotiations with Israel or conclude perhaps an informal agreement on a long-term ceasefire. And on that, there is some room for movement, including on the Israeli side.
Is there any form of Israeli long-term plan at all? Because what you seem to be describing essentially is a proposition for managing repetitive crises.
Yes, this is sort of an attempt to manage a crisis, manage a conflict. And of course, the problem is that often the conflict manages you, as we're seeing right now. In the long term, from the Israeli perspective, they view a few options. The sort of doomsday scenario would be that they have to go in and take over. If Israel ever got to that decision point of actually trying to topple Hamas, it militarily could do so, of course. The Israel forces are far stronger than Hamas, but it would be extremely bloody first for Gazans, but also to the Israeli military. And that is part of the reason that the Israelis are not keen to do so, to speak very mildly. They also fear, of course, what would happen the day after. Let's say they reoccupy the Gaza Strip, they enter as they were there before the Oslo Accords. What happens the day after? And then Israel would be left with governing a Gaza Strip, a rest of Gaza Strip, where still probably many Hamas people would be in hiding and fighting. That is why Israelis are very, very uninterested in that. But there are some, not many, but there are some in Israel that argue that if the status quo is as it is, which is so bloody, so recurring, and if Israeli civilians are constantly under this threat, and I would add also Gazans are in this condition, then perhaps the enormous cost of taking over the Gaza Strip would be justified. This is not the standard view. The standard view in Israel, and certainly among the decision makers in the military and the government, is that the status quo is better than that.
The other thing that we've seen in the course of these hostilities is actually what's been going on within Israel itself, between Arab Israelis and Jewish Israelis. Has that, do you think, changed Israeli thinking in any way?
It has. This has made a major psychological impact inside Israel. Some of it in the worst ways that one can imagine. Of course, when you see communal violence, the first thing it does is it strengthens tribal lines and makes people rally around the wagons, as they would say in the United States, trying to see the other, Jews versus Arabs, Arabs versus Jews, as sort of the violent instigator of everything. We're also seeing the reverse. We are seeing a lot of demonstrations of solidarity, attempts by Jews and Arabs to reach out to try and understand each other a bit better. It's worth remembering that 21% of Israel are Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, inside Israel itself. And most of the time, most days, they have daily lives beset, of course, with many problems, including structural inequality, but they live lives and cooperate and deal with Israelis all the time. But the Israeli government is viewing this, and the responses are varied. You see some calling, of course, for much more policing. By the way, that is also true among some of the leadership of the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are calling for much more policing in their own cities, which have had a neglect from the police and have more crime than they would otherwise. But also thinking that perhaps this conflict with Hamas should be shorter because Israel has so much to deal with internally, because what we're seeing now is really unrest across the Palestinian community, inside Israel, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, and in the Gaza Strip. This is a very different situation than we saw in the past, where things were much more segmented and, from the Israeli perspective, easier to deal with.
Natan Sachs reminding us that repetitively bloody though the Gazan conflict is, the more consequential changes may be happening in Israel and the West Bank. My thanks to him, Jennifer Jeffries, Nina Musgrave, and Fabian Hintz. We'll be back with our last programme in the series at the same time next week. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Sally Abrahams and Luke Radcliffe. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We've recently looked at what's happening in Hong Kong as Beijing tightens its grip there. We've explored various aspects of the COVID pandemic. And we've asked if Germany could go green as Angela Merkel steps off the stage.
Sneakers?
Trainers.
Whatever you want to call them, they are amongst the most iconic cultural objects of our time. But their evolution is a story rarely told until now.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Sneakonomics. Across this podcast, we're going to be telling the crazy origin stories of the most well-known sports companies and their relentless quest to be the world's number one brand.
Sneakonomics tells a story of fierce competition and rivalry. One that tore families and friendships apart, and even divided towns.
We'll follow in the footsteps of mavericks, hustlers and dreamers, and hear their tales of boom and bust, fame and infamy, hope and heartbreak. Above all, this is the story of the people behind the shoes. From BBC Radio 4, this is Sneakonomics.
Subscribe at BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello. It's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.